The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, the Southern Baptist Convention is holding its annual meeting. Now, this is the largest Protestant denomination in the country, and the event is going to be huge. The 2020 meeting, of course, was canceled, but this year, more than 16,000 people are expected to come to Nashville to elect a new president. The election will also be extremely contentious. Well-known members have left the group already in protest of the denomination's politics, and at the center of the rift is an essential question. How should evangelical Christians deal with systemic racism?
I spend my days and nights thinking about this split.
The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold has been reporting on the Southern Baptist Convention, and she spoke recently with one of its leading pastors. Eliza, what's on the table at this meeting? Why is the election of a new president for this group so complicated and so essential? This seems to an outsider like, I don't know, a routine piece of business.
So on one level, it's a fight over the role of racism inside of the Southern Baptists. But on another level, it's really a fight over the heart of the convention, over who holds the moral authority going forward. And what we're seeing now play out is this really new reckoning within the evangelical community. And what's happening is you have a group of hardliners. This is pre-Trump, right? This is 70s and 80s Christian right. For a long time, these hardliners have been using the Bible to double down on basically misogyny and racism. You know, women must be submissive, just old school ideas of leadership and white patriarchy. And what's happening and what's pretty exciting to watch is that and they're theologically conservative. I mean, these guys are no moderates, but they're standing up to the hardliners and saying, you know what? Don't use the Bible anymore to basically shore up the Republican Party.
And what caused it? What was the tipping point?
For those who aren't looking very closely, the most visible and vocal and vituperative talking point would be Donald Trump. But this has been happening for a much longer time. Part of it has to do with the weakening of churches in general. For the first time in history, we have less than half of Americans even going to church, who members of church. So as we see our institutions die, we see churches die, we see old categories between Democrats and Republicans break down, people no longer adhere to the old boxes. And that is super exciting because what will be born out of that has yet to be seen.
Right now, if you're looking at the right-leaning media, right-wing media, you are hearing all the time about critical race theory as if it's something that is dominant and infecting the culture in ways that we can't even begin to comprehend, that it's some sort of massive wave and influence. How did critical race theory take hold as such an enemy of the right, and how do they view what it is or isn't?
Critical race theory is simply a set of tools used mostly by legal scholars since the 70s and 80s to identify structural racism. It's that simple, but it's the latest boogeyman in a long line of academic theories that are threatening to the right, particularly the Christian right. These people are coming for your children. They're going to teach you that there is no God. You know, everyone's going to be a homosexual, all this kind of like fear mongering and fear baiting. And the fear of critical race theory is really being pushed by the hardliners who are running for president of the SBC right now. They talk about CRT as basically a form of racial discrimination against white people and a secular tool that is anti-biblical and therefore evil. Here's one of the candidates, Mike Stone, in an April interview he gave to another pastor named Matthew Tarpley.
When Southern Baptists were dealing with these issues using nothing but the Word of God, led by and filled with the Holy Spirit of God, we've been making progress in these areas. But since these unbiblical ideologies were injected into the bloodstream of Southern Baptist conversation, we have seen nothing in the last nearly 2 years now, nothing on this issue except increased hostility, accusations, conflict. And I think that's by design. By that, I mean by demonic design, because these unbiblical ideologies, they are not tools of unity. They are weapons of division.
What makes critical race theory different from a lot of these other basically fear-based tactics is to say that it doesn't exist negates the experience of people of color so profoundly that it makes people on the right willing to step out of that.
Eliza, you recently spoke to Pastor Dwight McKissick. Who is he, and what is his story? What's his background?
So Dwight McKissick is a pastor of a church with 3,000 to 4,000 people in Arlington, Texas. And he watched, really with the election of Trump and pre-election of Trump, watched the kind of growing support for white nationalism inside of the Southern Baptists with alarm.
In the process of studying the election and determining how I would vote, I discovered a group called the alt-right. And they were associated with the Republican Party. So I began to research them. What do they believe? What are they thinking? And it was apparent to me that they were a white supremacist group. They believed that Western society was superior. They believed that white people were God's special, chosen, significant people. And I discovered there were those in the Southern Baptist ranks who were a part of the alt-right. And so I constructed a resolution.
He decided in 2017 at this big conference they have that he was going to call on his fellow Southern Baptists to come out against white nationalism and the alt-right. And just a little context, there was some precedent for this. In 1995, the SBC issued a formal apology for the role that slavery played from its very inception in the 1800s. So in some ways, McKissick's resolution continued in that more recent tradition of attempting to call out racism within the SBC.
I thought it would be a no-brainer. The committee would accept it, and they would vote that the SBC was totally opposed to alt-right and white supremacist ideology. And when that resolution did not get out of committee, man, that was just a major shocker.
Twice the vote to support this failed.
So they did vote the third time after voting down twice on the third round. And I think it was solely so that they wouldn't be embarrassed. They acquiesced.
How did it feel to watch this going down?
It was a feeling of exasperation. It was a feeling of shock. I was stunned, actually. And black pastors coming to me saying, "We're out. This is clear. We feel like the other here. This can't be our home. If people have to vote twice on our dignity, something is fundamentally flawed here."
He needs to decide whether or not he's going to stay within the Southern Baptists. So he'll do that in the coming days based on who is elected president for the Southern Baptists this year.
I'd been a loyalist. I penned an editorial for the Washington Post a few years ago about why I'm remaining Southern Baptist. And so I was really trying to, I've appealed to black pastors, don't leave, let's help make it right. But here we are again, some 3 years later, 4 years later, and the CRT is just another way of muscling the ox, trying to police racial discussions. And if this is approved, white people alone will determine what can and can't be said about race within literature, Sunday school literature, from lecture stands, and to the degree you buy into it from your pulpit, they have will declare that anybody who says any modicum of CRT, critical race theory, may be true, you're out of touch with the Baptist faith and message. You would no longer be doctrinally in line with the Southern Baptist Convention. So this is horrible what's happening in this regard. I believe God is judging the Southern Baptist Convention. Make an issue out of CRT, something's drastically wrong with that.
You know, you and I have talked about when those young pastors sided with you in 2017, you saw a new moral heart beating within the Southern Baptists.
Yes.
And there is a larger moral crisis. There are new forces working here where conservatives, ultra-conservatives will say, have gotten so far from the Bible that they're using culture as scripture. And on the other side, you have people who would also call themselves theologically conservative and are, who are saying, in your fight of the culture wars, you guys have left the Bible behind. Does that seem right to you?
I think you've described it quite well. I think the ground has shifted from the fundamentalist takeover, conservative resurgent group, whatever you want to call them, that had these hardline views on race and women, but because they could uphold the inerrancy of the Bible and the exclusivity of Jesus Christ and some doctrines that we all would share, people sort of gave them a pass on their racial views and their views on women. But you have a generation now. This is not their grandfather's convention anymore. We will not go back. We want theological orthodoxy, theological conservatism, if you want to call it that, but we don't want misogyny, and we don't want racism, nor do we want Christian nationalism, nor do we want some kind of fusion between the Republican Party and the Southern Baptist Convention. That's the new group that's coming up to the front, and I pray God help that group to win come Nashville next week.
So we are standing at this precipice. You lead a church of 3,000 to 4,000 people.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So if in the coming days, the Southern Baptists elect one of the two people who supports this kind of thinking, these hardliners who really aren't taking racism seriously, are you ready to leave the Southern Baptists?
You know, my heart is torn. There's a side of me says, I'd rather light candles than curse darkness. And the SBC is what it is. It sometimes seems hopeless. But there's another side of me that says, and people have been calling me this week, says, I'm needed, my position is needed, and God may be purging and cleansing the SBC. And things you've been fighting for years are now maybe moving in the right direction. You shouldn't leave. So the only thing I can tell you, I'm torn. I'm torn at this point.
Has any of this shaken your faith in any way?
It has not. If anything, it has strengthened my faith, and it has caused me to appreciate the faith of my childhood that was basically by law and common culture segregated. I didn't have the option in my childhood of attending a white Southern Baptist church, even if I wanted to. But no, it has not shaken my faith. Ironically, though, there is a black pastor who has confided in me. He because of SBC's position on CRT and their views and practice of race, he said it has caused him to question, is it legit? Is the faith legitimate? Are we reading the same Bible? How do they think like this? And it has literally shaken his faith, and we're ministering to him. So I do know of a pastor who is causing him to rethink the validity of the entire Christian faith.
That's Pastor Dwight McKissick of Texas talking with Eliza Griswold. Now, Eliza, if one of these hardliners is elected president at the convention this week, and Dwight McKissick walks out, and if other black pastors and more progressive churches leave the Southern Baptist Convention, then what?
The aftershocks of what will happen in Nashville really remain to be seen. If there is an exodus of pastors of color and other churches and a hardliner wins, the economic fallout of that in terms of contributions to the convention could be quite significant. For the past couple of years, the convention has already been losing both members and money. So continuing on that downward trend could seriously weaken its hold over American religion, over evangelicalism in America. If it turns out that there is this crisis of moral authority within the SBC, and that crisis reflects larger splits within American evangelicalism, we're talking about nearly 100 million Americans who are going to be wrestling with what it means to be a good person and what it means to follow Jesus in new ways that we really haven't seen since the 1980s.
Eliza Griswold, thanks so much.
David, thank you.
You can read Eliza's piece, The Fight for the Heart of the Southern Baptist Convention, at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Summer is the season of blockbusters normally, and nothing beats the heat like a dark, icy cold movie theater. Blasts of air conditioning. A great movie. But last summer, the studios delayed most of the big releases, and we had to sweat it out, watching TV from our increasingly dusty couches. But now the movies are back.
Hey, y'all. Good morning.
Ice cold piragua, palcha, china, cherry, strawberry, and just for today, I got my mate.
Oh, yeah. Piragua.
In the Heights is based on Lin-Manuel Miranda's 2008 Tony-winning musical.
I am Usnavi, and you probably never heard my name. Reports of my fame are greatly exaggerated, exacerbated by...
And it's easy to see why the director, John M. Chu, was absolutely adamant that this movie wait until we could see it in theaters. It's big, it's colorful, it's noisy, it's joyful. The dance sequences are complex, a spectacle in the very best sense.
Me and my cousin running, just another dime a dozen, mom and pop stop and shout, and oh my God, it's got it chewed on high.
In the Heights is a love letter to the largely Latino community in Washington Heights in northern Manhattan. And the characters are dreaming big and wrestling with what happens when those dreams start to pull them farther and farther away from the old neighborhood. John Chu was also the director of 2018's Crazy Rich Asians, the highest grossing romantic comedy of the past decade. I reached him in Los Angeles. Can you play that guitar behind you?
I used to when I was younger.
Because I was going to say terrible. We could blow off the interview and the two of us can play together.
The reality is it's blocking a plug.
That's you know what? Home decoration is home decoration. John, I want to start by asking you about location. You're from the Bay Area. And of course, In the Heights was filmed on location in Washington Heights in Upper Manhattan. Tell me about the first time you visited the neighborhood and I guess in a sense scouted it out and got a feel for it.
Yeah, I was meeting with Lynn for the first time and he said, come, just meet Washington Heights. And he took me in, he showed me where he lives, where Kiara lives, who wrote the original book and the screenplay. And they showed me where the best Cafe Con Leche is. They showed me where the Piragua guy on the corner that they buy from. They showed me the bodegas that they like to frequent. They showed me where the best handball game was at. I didn't even know fully what handball was. So to me,
they don't have handball in the Bay Area.
I mean, they do, but I didn't, you know, I'm not around that a lot. So it was just interesting to see how integrated everything was in their lives. And, you know, I've probably drove through Washington Heights, not really paying attention, but this time I got to see where Lynn shot his home videos in this 191st Street tunnel. Never seen. I was like, this place is blowing my mind. Kiara was like, oh, that's where we go swimming every summer. So we went in there. It was not scripted. We went in there. We're like, this is the most crazy pool I've ever seen. We have to do something here.
It's incredible that there is a Busby Berkeley musical scene right there in Washington Heights. It's something glorious.
And they don't match their costumes. They're all different skin colors, all different shapes and sizes, all different ages from 5 to 81. Their towels don't match. And it's the most beautiful, exuberant thing. Like, they could have been in those movies back then and just weren't there, weren't allowed to. And I'm so glad that we got it on film.
No, you grew up with movies and movies and movies and have seen hundreds of them. Were any films important to you to get the look and feel for In the Heights as you and your colleagues try to imagine it?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with musicals, both on stage and in movies. I mean, Meet Me in St. Louis was something that, you know, is about home that has, I don't know if that was Lynn's thing, but for me, things like Royal Wedding, of course, Spinning of the Room, everyone tries to copy that, but we had an idea of doing it outside and having the building become a ballroom. Even music videos, even like Michael Jackson videos, even stuff that influenced my growing up and seeing music in different ways.
Now, Crazy Rich Asians was the first major Hollywood film with an all-Asian cast in a very long time, nearly 25 years. And now, within The Heights, you've made a film that's got an entirely Latino cast. How do you approach making a film about a community that you are not a part of?
You listen a lot. Well, you have a real conversation with Lynn and Kiara and say, am I the right person? I signed on to this before Crazy Rich Asians. So at that point, I didn't even think twice about it. But after Crazy Rich Asians, after experiencing that whole that thing, I realized the power that this movie could have. And I wanted to make sure that they knew that they had an out if they didn't think I was the right person to do it. And I sat down with them. And in the end of it, they were like, John, you're our guy. You have the vision. Also, we're going to be there. So calm down. We're going to be right there with you, John, to make sure you do it right.
I read that before the shooting started, he wrote, don't fuck this up on a corner of your script.
Yes.
That one was a joke, I imagine. But there's got to be a lot of pressure directing a movie like this, especially after the huge success that you had with Crazy Rich Asians. Were those external pressures and, you know, the weight on your shoulder the same as the ones that you placed on yourself in the prior movie?
Yeah, even more so, actually.
Why is that?
I knew I was already one step removed from this neighborhood, and I knew the power, and I knew, how do you translate? How do you make sure you don't miss a detail? And the director is probably the only person on set who can stop everything and say, let's discuss this. And, oh, that sauce is wrong. Okay, go take 30 minutes, go get the right one and get back here. I'm the only one who can say that. And so I made room for that. And I was very hyper aware all the time that, oh, her hair is going to get in her way, but those are her natural curls. Don't clip it back. Move the light. Move the camera. Mm-hmm. And so those little things, I think, that was what made me nervous, making sure I was always present to hear those things.
Were there points of connection that you felt to the story from your own life?
For sure. I remember seeing it on Broadway for the first time. And I didn't know who Lin-Manuel Miranda was at that time. But he expressed everything that I felt about growing up in an immigrant community, my own, on the other side of the country in a Chinese restaurant. I knew what it felt like to have aunties and uncles raise me. I knew what the weight of the of their stories put on your shoulders. I'm the youngest of five kids. I knew who
your dad's a chef, right?
My dad's a chef, yeah. Working hard, someone who worked hard and believed very deeply that he represented the community to a community that was outside of us. And that was our responsibility. By the way, the restaurant's still there 51 years later.
Give the restaurant a plug nationally right now.
Chef Chu's in Los Altos, California, 51 years.
We're there. Okay.
And so that to me, I 100% understood the universality of this, mm-hmm. of this show, this story. And so that's where we connected mostly.
If I won the lotto tomorrow, well, I know I wouldn't bother going on no spending spree. I pick a business school and pay the entrance fee. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll stay friends with me. I'll be a businessman richer than.
Let's go back a little bit in time around 2015, 2016, before Crazy Rich Asians, before you're a rocket ship off into outer space in Hollywood, and you were coming off your film Gem and the Holograms, which was not a box office explosion. And you've described this period as a moment of real reevaluation for yourself. What were you trying to figure out? Where were you? What was going on?
By the way, I love Gem and the Holograms. I'm very proud of that movie. Critics didn't like it and people didn't show up for it. However, I still really love it. That said, when I first got into the business, I won the lottery. I literally, Steven Spielberg saw my short film. I got right in. I didn't have to PA on any movie before. I got a studio film and I was directing movies for big movie studios, never an independent movie. And so when you win the lottery, the problem is you don't know how you won. You just accept the prize and then you have to keep going. And so you're faking it. And so it took me many, many movies to feel like, do I even deserve to be here? Am I doing this right? Oh, that's what coverage is. Oh, that's how I work with a studio. Oh, this is how marketing works. Okay. Took me many movies to finally get to a point where I realized that I know what I'm doing and I deserve to be here, even if I caught a lucky break. It was at that point that Gem happened. And when your box office is the determining factor and then you don't land on it and it makes you empty, I had to think about, why am I doing this again? Is it because of the box office? And if it was, then why was I doing it when I was 9 years old? Why did I want to do it back then? And so it was this point that I started looking for something that spoke to me, something that only I could make, only with the skill set that I had that I could make.
What did you turn down? What was the struggle like?
I was supposed to do another G.I. Joe, which was a big movie with The Rock. I was supposed to do another Now You See Me with that amazing cast who I love dearly. And I had other things coming my way. The problem was like, that wasn't me. It wasn't me. I just felt like the right time to do something that scared me.
Crazy Rich Asians made a huge splash, not only because it was so entertaining and fun, but obviously because of the breakthrough that it represented. Have things changed much since then for Asian American directors, performers, and what hasn't?
Yeah, I mean, I think progress has been made. I think this last year it shows that it hasn't been made fast enough. By the time I came out of Crazy Rich Asians, I think the box office proved that people were ready for something like this.
You think Hollywood learned a lesson?
I'm not sure they learned a lesson. I think they had no choice. Like, things were changing all the way around them. So it was coming whether they wanted to or not. And I had a little bit of power now after Crazy Rich Asians. And Lin had a lot of power because he had just done Hamilton. So I think commerce still is the thing that drove the power to make this stuff happen. Like, I don't paint over that. That's a reality. But there's this bigger urgency. Because when rhetoric of othering Asians, especially Asian Americans right now, that causes a lot of problems and creates violence as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been screaming it from the top of our lungs for a while, but when it becomes very, very real for us, when our grandmothers or our friends or our families can't go on a walk or are very scared of that stuff, it just shows that, like, it makes you confused. You don't know how to stop this. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to do. But as storytellers, the only thing we can do is just share who we are. Just share, and believe, at least on my side, that when people see it, they will see a human being and will hopefully have more empathy. In the same way my dad, having the restaurant, when people would treat him poorly at the rest, I would watch this and I would get mad for him. He'd be like, John, we are ambassadors here. We started in 1969. There were no Asian Chinese restaurants here. When they come in here, we're their first Chinese family. And we're going to fill their bellies and fill their hearts. And when they walk out of here, I don't care how they treat me. When they walk out of here, if they see another Chinese family, I want them to respect them and think that they're going to fill their hearts as well.
Yeah. There's been a lot of attention paid to anti-Asian violence and abuse. And I certainly have seen it in my city in New York. And I wonder if you've experienced this or people you know have experienced this.
I mean, I've experienced it in my life. I wouldn't say I experienced it in the last year because I haven't been out. But I've definitely been more cautious, and especially with my own kids going out. I'm definitely on my eye looking. But I remember in college, I was with my girlfriend at the time, and we were going to like a Ralph's, and some guy started yelling at me from the street, "Go home, go back to your country," saying all this stuff. I just ignored it because that's what I do. I didn't even think twice about it. I was just going to my car. So I just kept doing that. And my girlfriend, who was white, was like, "What?" She got mad at him, got in his face. I was like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." I was like, "What are you doing?" She's like, "How can you?" He just said all that stuff. I was like, "Oh, he did?" I was like, I just don't give any energy to that. Like if I gave energy to that, that person gets it and I don't want. So if someone says that, you're not worth my time, I'm moving forward. That was the first time I realized, like, have I been doing that my whole life? That's crazy. That is crazy.
Now, we mentioned your dad and the restaurant and your family. And I wonder, have they seen the film?
They've seen the film.
How'd they react?
They saw an early version and they loved it. However, I would say the last time they just watched it in the theater across the street from the restaurant. And my dad called me crying. And I haven't heard him cry over a movie, not even Crazy Rich Asians. That he's like, this is very, very special. And he's not from Washington Heights. I felt like I could have gotten the best reaction from him from Crazy Rich Asians, which I got a great reaction from them. That was the first time I felt like they were proud. But this one, there was something, he was truly proud. There was something different.
John, you've got two kids and your son was born during the production of this movie and his middle name is? Heights.
Oh, yeah, we call him Heights.
Tell me about the decision to name him Heights, or at least his middle name.
Yeah, part of the process of shooting this movie was being in Washington Heights and learning about the community. And they were so warm, so beautiful, yelled at us, of course, if we were in their parking spot. We would eat their food, listen to their music. And I just loved this idea of people dreaming. I related to that. So I wanted to say the word Heights every day of my life. And I wanted my son to hear those words every day of his life.
Amazing. The film is In the Heights, and the director is John M. Chu. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, good sir.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I remember waking up one morning and seeing the pre-market price had jumped up to like $200. I just like got up and just like started dancing basically because it's like, let's go. I can't believe this is actually working out. We're making money.
Early this year in January, you might remember some pretty unusual business news.
The internet takes on Wall Street. This story is stunning. The stock price for GameStop, which is a retail video game store, has been surging more than 600%.
So you were literally dancing in your room?
Yeah, I was for a bit, yeah. Not gonna lie, I was.
Cody Herdman at the time was a college freshman, and he and a few million other small investors did something unprecedented. They took a stock that Wall Street considered just about worthless, the video game retailer called GameStop, and bought it. They bought lots of it, which sent the price soaring.
Like seeing $2,000 magically overnight basically turn into like $6,000-$7,000.
The media used words like frenzy and madness and rebellion, and TV news went absolutely biblical.
What some people are calling a David and Goliath struggle.
To a David versus Goliath showdown. Amateur day traders
taking on some of Wall Street's most powerful hedge funds in an epic David versus Goliath showdown.
But why? What was the GameStop squeeze really all about? Our producer Alex Barron decided to dive straight in.
So it's January 27th, I'm at home in Brooklyn, and my entire newsfeed is just GameStop, GameStop, GameStop. I am not an investment guy. I've never bought an individual share of stock in my life, but I found all of this really exciting. And so I spent $400 to buy a share of GameStop. Actually, 1.090222 shares. And it's not until I hit send on the order that I think, for the first time, that by buying GameStop, I maybe just joined some kind of movement. So the GameStop story seems to me like the latest in a long line of situations where something unusual happening online causes something really unusual to happen in the quote-unquote real world. Think about something like QAnon, or on a totally different note, Me Too. These are movements that start online and end up totally reshaping the offline world. And it seemed to me that GameStop could be a movement like that, something that would fundamentally shake up the global financial system. So I think to myself, I should try to figure out exactly what this movement is. So I called Sheila Cole Hatkar, who writes about business for The New Yorker. I guess let's start with like a building block of this story, which is like, what is a short squeeze?
Do you want to talk about what a short is first?
Yeah. Okay. What's a short?
So short selling. as a side note, I think I've had to define what short selling is in like 50% of my New Yorker stories.
So here's what Sheila explains to me. There are these big-time investors like hedge funds, and they were shorting GameStop.
So instead of betting that a stock is going to rise in price, you're betting that it's going to go down.
And it made sense that GameStop, a brick-and-mortar retailer in the midst of a pandemic, would go down. So some investors on the internet notice that these hedge funds are shorting GameStop, and they start buying GameStop and driving the price up. They want to create something called a short squeeze.
And the higher the price goes, the more pressure it puts on the people who are short the stock, and it can lead to them having to go and buy the stock back at a really inflated price. And yes, if you have a big short position, a short squeeze is your nightmare.
So potentially huge losses for the hedge funds, but also huge gains for regular investors. And all of this is happening at a moment of convergence of a few things. So first of all, there's the pandemic. People are stuck at home and they're bored and they're looking for something to do. Second, there are all these apps that let average people like me trade stocks commission-free. I had bought GameStop using the most popular one of those apps, which is called Robinhood. Sheila actually just wrote a whole story about Robinhood for the magazine.
It's a fun, easy to use app on your phone. So Robinhood had the effect of, you know, driving a lot of new investors into the market. And those people, the same sorts of people who were attracted to Robinhood, many of them were the similar sorts of people who were looking at these online message boards.
The message boards, that's the third part of this convergence. What Sheila's talking about is mainly a community on Reddit called Wall Street Bets. That's the place where all these investors got together and kind of created the GameStop squeeze. So I started spending a lot of time on Wall Street Bets, and it is not your average investment community.
It has a really strong reputation, actually, for being semi-serious. I mean, there's a lot of joking around and inappropriate, you know, cartoons and so on being posted. But many traders I spoke to claimed that they had come up with good trading ideas by reading Wall Street Bets. Hmm.
Just to give a rundown of what's on the front page of Wall Street Bets right now, we got a GIF of a guy like really getting beat up going down a slide. It says, "My portfolio the last week be like..." It's a lot of people posting like big losses.
Loss
proudly
porn.
Posting big losses. Loss porn. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little painful.
Yeah.
But I guess some people think this is entertaining, which it is on some level.
Wall Street Bets describes itself as like 4chan found a Bloomberg terminal. So they proudly compare themselves to 4chan, one of the most controversial sites on the internet, the place where people go to post memes and also hate speech, the site that birthed the QAnon movement. Wall Street Bets says, "We're like that, but for finance." And this is one of the things that starts making me suspicious of that simple David and Goliath narrative. I may not know a lot about investing, but I do know that internet communities are messy places. On Wall Street Bets, there are activists, there are trolls, and there are a lot of people who really aren't either of those things. So I started talking to some of them.
Hey.
Hey, Cody.
Sorry, my settings for this are off. I was doing something else. Let me try and get changed around.
This is Cody Herdman again, the 19-year-old investor who was dancing in his dorm room. Cody goes to Dakota State University in South Dakota. He likes video games and metal detecting, and he plays on the school football team.
Well, actually, because of COVID, our school lost most of its funding, so they ended up cutting my scholarship, which kind of sucks. But so I'm just doing all my stuff on my own time now. Just going to the gym, doing all my own running and whatnot.
Sheila put us in touch. She had talked to Cody for her Robinhood piece for the magazine. He was a regular Wall Street Bets user. He just kind of liked the way people talked about investing there. Memes are like a second language for Cody.
I mean, as a Zoomer or whatever, as someone who's, I mean, been very in the meme culture for a very long time, I mean, it was a lot more appealing to see other people that, I mean, had the same sense of humor as me, I guess, instead of just... Boomer ranting about stocks and words that are too big for me to possibly understand.
So late last year, Cody's on Wall Street Bets, and he notices people talking about GameStop and the possibility of making a lot of money investing in it. So Cody gets very excited about this, and he buys in. And pretty quickly, GameStop's price starts to go up.
And I think I was up to like $2,000.
And 2,000 bucks. So, like, what's 2,000 bucks to you? That sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had a ton of money at once. Like, so, that's, to me, obviously, that's a lot of money.
Cody bought GameStop at an average price of around $40. So, the day it hit $350 was a big day. Cody was up like $25,000.
I mean, it wasn't. I'm not a good dancer. I wasn't doing anything crazy. I mean, it was more of just kind of a little happy dance type thing.
So, to sum up, Cody likes Wall Street Bets. People on Wall Street Bets like GameStop. Cody buys GameStop. Cody makes money. That story makes perfect sense to me. But that's not David versus Goliath. It doesn't sound like Cody bought GameStop to stick it to the man. It sounds like he bought GameStop because he thought he'd make money. And he did. But this is where things get really interesting. Because after Cody invested, after he bought GameStop, his investment became a David versus Goliath story.
Where did sticking it to the hedge funds fit into like the list of reasons why you were interested in being part of the GameStop pump?
Originally, that wasn't really a part of it. But then like when I wrote that whole piece, I guess, about how we're fighting the hedgies, I mean, avenge our fathers type thing. I mean, that was definitely a big part of it.
Cody is talking about something he posted on a Wall Street Bets comment thread the day after the stock hit the $350 mark. On January 28th, he wrote, in part, I am holding to ensure my parents can live comfortable lives at the expense of the assholes that almost cost them their lives. This is for you, Dad. Cody explained to me that his family lost a lot of money in the financial crash.
My dad got really screwed over in 08, and I do want to see these hedgies suffer. I mean, like I said, kind of almost a spiritual successor to Occupy Wall Street at this point, where it's like we're, instead of literally occupying it, we are going to bankrupt you.
Now, Cody's just one guy, but for me, he's the kind of GameStop investor I hadn't heard about as much in all the coverage. Somebody whose reasons for participating in the GameStop squeeze were too complicated to fit a simple narrative. I found other people like that, too.
I had my baby, and I was just like, you know, I want to do something kind of exciting just for fun. I want to get involved in this.
I would be lying if I said it didn't scratch an itch, but there are a lot of things that scratch an itch. I love playing video games. I love playing chess. It doesn't have to be gambling. It doesn't have to be money-oriented. I'm great at finding things to become obsessive about.
I think, like, the progressive left really tried to pick up on this and paint it as, like, the working class rising up. And it wasn't any of that. It was not political.
That's Sarah Henry, also a GameStop investor, also a Wall Street Bets user, although...
I hate Wall Street Bets. I think the people there are awful. They are awful people. They are absolutely awful people. And if you just simply, like, zen out your mind and go, like, I'm not going to pay attention to any of that. I just want you to say, this is what I think is going to happen with gold and silver commodities in the next 6 months. Here's why I am playing long. Here's my due diligence.
Getting involved in GameStop definitely paid off for Sarah.
So my initial investment was $6,000. My total winnings were about $28,000. So I came out of the whole thing with $22,000 in net profit.
By the way, if you're wondering why it sounds like Sarah's camping, it's because she kind of is. She lives in an RV that she drives around Europe, and she makes money investing. And the way she described her decision to invest in GameStop, it stuck with me.
My initial buy-in was just simply based on the fact that this felt like a thing that was going to happen. And it did.
It felt like something was going to happen, and it did. That maybe sounds like a really arbitrary reason to do anything, but it's also maybe the closest anyone I talked to came to expressing why I bought GameStop on January 27th. I mean, look, a lot of what happens online can seem deeply weird, and it can feel comforting to try to say that there's some simple ideology behind it. A bunch of people wanted to take down Wall Street banks, so they got together on this subreddit and decided to buy a bunch of GameStop. But that story doesn't capture why every one of us participated in this movement, especially not at first.
I think in many, many aspects of life, and especially in many aspects of online life, ideology is a retroactive fit.
I ran this theory by Andrew Marantz. Andrew is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he wrote a book about online communities called Antisocial.
I think this is true of everyone, that, like, it's about the rocket ship emojis. It's about the, like, memes. That is, like, honestly how most of us form our decisions. And then to say, like, I did this because of the financial crash is, like, okay, maybe to some extent you did, but, like, really? Was that really your primary motivation? Like, it just seems like that's not actually how life works.
When we talked, Andrew had just come across a quote from the literary critic Lionel Trilling from his book The Liberal Imagination, published in 1950.
And it's exactly about this aspect of the internet. I just read this, like, this morning, but it says, "Ideology is not acquired by thought, as he put it, but by breathing the haunted air. It is a strange, submerged life of habit and semi-habit in which to ideas we attach strong passions but no very clear awareness of the concrete reality of their consequences."
Now, if you followed the GameStop story at the time, you know that there are many other chapters here. Robinhood and a couple of other platforms eventually started limiting users' ability to buy GameStop stock. Politicians got angry. Congress held hearings. And some people started to wonder if maybe the whole squeeze might have been manipulated by those same rich traders that Wall Street Bets people thought they were sticking it to. Things on the internet, never as simple as you want them to be. At any rate, there are a lot more of us in the market now than there were before. In addition to the Robinhood app, there's Fidelity, E-Trade, other platforms that let people like me trade stock commission-free. And Wall Street Bets has gone from around 2 million subscribers at the beginning of the year to around 10 million now. So whether or not I'm part of an ideological movement, I'm definitely part of a financial movement. I asked Sheila Kolhatkar about this, what's been called the democratization of finance. Would you anticipate that GameStop is going to be the last convulsion like this that we're going to see driven by this new flood of retail investors?
I think what the GameStop thing proved is that how easy it is for something like this to happen. All it takes is a little bit of momentum to build on one of these websites or on some other platform. So in fact, I think we should be expecting to see many more episodes like this. And in fact, I think it's going to be happening a lot more. I think now that all these tools are in everyone's hands, it's going to shake things up.
As for me, I ended up selling my 1.090222 shares of GameStop. I took a loss of $155. I was too late to the game. But I'm not going to stop investing. There are other opportunities like GameStop. Just in the last month, retail investors have driven up the price of AMC movie theaters more than 500%. I mean, with so many new people in the market, who knows what could happen?
Yeah, basically I'm now invested like $40,000 into like half meme stocks, half ETFs.
I would totally do it again, maybe even three times a year now.
We're not talking about a short squeeze anymore. This is now a fight. It's now a revolution because all of Wall Street Bets is here.
So, I mean, there's still a very, very large amount of people in this where it should work out if things go our way.
That story came from Alex Barron, a producer on our program, and you can read Sheila Kolhatkar on Robinhood Investors and much more about the world of business at newyorker.com. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening and have a great week. We also want to say a special thank you this week to WNYC's Emily Mann. Best of luck, Emily. We'll miss you.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.